yeah, 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 yeah. Brassy girls everywhere, titty ass hands in the air. So party over here, shaking for the man of the year. Man of the year, man of the bounce. Brassy girls everywhere, titty ass hands in the air. So party over here, shaking for the man of the year. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked. And this week, we're listening to Man of the Year by Schoolboy Q, which is appropriate because, first of all, he has a new album out this week called Blank Face. Ironic since he's my favorite artist with a face tattoo. I haven't had a chance to listen to that one yet, though, so this is probably my favorite song off his last album. And it's appropriate to this week's subject matter because we're talking about probably the one thing that all time men and women of the year have in common: emotional intelligence, charisma, an ability to read people, you know, whether they use it for good or bad. Martin Luther King Jr. was a master manipulator of human emotion, and so was Hitler. And the reason we're talking about that is because of our interview guest this week. This week we're talking to, not Hitler, pretty sure we'd get featured as one of the new and noteworthy podcasts in iTunes if we scored an interview with him. I'm talking to Chris Voss, not as much of a household name as Hitler. I think he'd admit that, but he is the former FBI lead international kidnapping negotiator. And the conversation ends up being less about, you know, ways to trick bad guys into coming near the window so you can shout, "Take the shot!" into your walkie-talkie, which is sort of what I expected going in. Thought when I called him and said, "Is this Chris?" he might say something cagey like, "Why don't you tell me who you think it is?" But after reading his book and talking to him, I actually kept thinking about David Foster Wallace's speech slash essay, "This is Water," which is probably not what you were expecting me to say this book on hostage negotiation reminded me of. You probably expected me to say it reminded me of Hitler, just based on the fact that 40% of the words I've said so far in this introduction have been Hitler. But if you don't know David Foster Wallace, he's a great American writer, and he starts this essay, "This is Water," with this anecdote about two young fish swimming along when an older fish swims by and nods and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" It's not a true anecdote. And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then one of them looks over and goes, "What the hell is water?" And that's how this, I think it was a commencement speech, starts. And then he goes on to explain why figuring out the answer to that question is basically the secret to life. Not the question, "What is water?" That would make life so much easier. But what is the human equivalent to what water is to those fish in that story? Like the thing that we take for granted, that we're so close to, we don't even know it exists, and that totally affects how our days go and eventually how our lives are lived. And Foster Wallace's answer is partially what he calls default settings that the human mind operates on. These sort of automated systems that control your thoughts are our water. And if you never think about how they're warping the way you see and interact with the world, you're going to be miserable, is basically his thesis. And we've sort of touched on this idea in the context of the book Incognito with David Eagleman, about how something like 90% of the mind is run by automated processes that our conscious mind doesn't have access to. That book kind of makes it seem like the conscious part of the mind is making up a story after the fact to explain the decisions made by these default settings, which I think is certainly one way that humans make decisions. And I think we've also talked about it in the context of the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, which comes up again today. It's about these automatic cognitive biases that warp the way we see the world. We'll talk about one of them during our conversation, loss aversion, but Kahneman won the Nobel Prize for identifying 150 of these different glitches in our mind matrix that cause us to make irrational decisions and warp the way we evaluate the world. For instance, one of the illustrations is they ask people if they'd rather have surgery that has a survival rate of 90% or surgery with a mortality rate of 10%. And even though those are the same things, people always opt for the 90% survival rate because it sounds better. It's a framing bias. We also have an optimism bias, just as a species. One example that stuck out to me is that the average estimated cost for kitchen remodelings is $18,000 and the average actual cost is $39,000. So Kahneman starts with these seemingly very basic glitches in our cognitive matrix and demonstrates that they affect you almost every day of your life. He identifies 150, and he identified them by designing lab experiments, but Chris Voss, our guest today, lived his experiments. He started his negotiating career volunteering at a suicide hotline, got onto New York's hostage negotiation team just in time for one of the only bank robberies with hostages in the past 40 years, and then began negotiating with kidnappers and terrorists around the world for the FBI. So he spent his career learning and studying how the human mind works in motion, and his experiences taught him a bunch of emotional mechanisms that cause us to behave irrationally, to throw into the mix with Kahneman's cognitive biases. So we're going to be talking about his book, Never Split the Difference, which sort of pitches itself as business advice, which I'm not crazy about, I'll be honest, who wants to make businessmen better at tricking people into giving them what they want. But there's this cliche, the mind is an excellent servant, but a terrible master, that Foster Wallace quotes in This Is Water. And that's what I think Voss is ultimately interested in his book and in our conversation, learning about all the irrational ways the mind behaves so you can make it work for you rather than control and kind of betray you. And the other unequivocally good takeaway from the book, and the main reason it reminded me of This Is Water, is because they're both really about paying attention to other people. The thesis of This Is Water comes at the end when he says, the really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty, little, unsexy ways every day. That is real freedom. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. And if I had to sum up Voss's technique for interacting with other people, it would be to pay attention to them. View everything they say as an opportunity to learn something about them. And yeah, after talking to him, I guess I just generally felt like I never had an excuse to ever be bored again. There are just too many people to interact with and pay attention to and learn about. So I hope you get some of that from our conversation instead of new way to trick someone you have a crush on into sleeping with you, or how to sweep a down on its luck nation into a nationalistic genocidal frenzy. I specifically hope you don't learn either of those things. So I hope you enjoy it. I'll be back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. Home and slinging on the curb. We cards every corner sell her. Watch it fly to a bird. Nigga, I can pitch you a curb. Let this real shit occur. Make meals from a verb. Nigga, cop a crib in the burbs. Nigga, you ain't said nothing but a word. Smoke something for your nerve. Home of the paid on the first. Then nigga going broke by the third. Bounce for the crown. Fast forward getting real to me now. Every dog need a cat to meow. Every once in a while I see hands in the crowd. See white, black, blaze in the pound. Jump, jumping around. So I'm joined by Chris Voss, who is a professor at Georgetown's Business School and USC's Business School as well. But before that, you were the lead hostage negotiator for the FBI. Is that right?
I was the lead international kidnapping negotiator. So yeah, commodities dealership.
So you have a new book out, Never Split the Difference, that is a fascinating read. And one of the details from your time in the FBI that really jumped out at me was that when you guys are on the phone negotiating with somebody, whether it's a kidnapper or a terrorist, the FBI will have five listeners on the phone listening in, which I don't know, that really jumped out to me as something that I clearly am not listening hard enough if the FBI has five listeners all listening in, paying attention to different things.
Yeah, man, actually, you know, it's kind of a big disadvantage in business now also. I never go into an important negotiation without at least one wingman, because if you're going to talk and listen, you just can't do it. I mean, there's too much. If you're just listening by itself, there's too much information coming off the other person between what they say and how they say it. And that's where you tell you, listen between the lines. And that's just the beginning. And you start to think about the adjectives they use and the personal pronouns that they use. And I've been in negotiations where, business negotiations, where somebody with me said, I can't believe that you missed a point that they made. And I will say, look, I don't even remember them saying it because at that moment I was trying to think of what I was going to say. So, yeah, more listeners in any negotiation, the better off you are.
Yeah, as somebody who often when I meet somebody at a party and just freaking out about what I'm doing with my hands or whether my handshake was firm enough and have never once remembered somebody's name after the first time they told it to me, I can completely identify with that. But a lot of the technique that you kind of outline in the book is really this kind of close, almost textual analysis of what the person who you're negotiating with has to say. And really, you talk about conversations of all sort, basically, as various forms of negotiation. But rather than having an agenda and coming in and having all these gambits and tricks that you play on people, it seems like first and foremost, it's about listening to what people say. So I guess it might be interesting for the listener to hear you describe what you're listening for.
First of all, the stuff that changes. You're looking for differences. And solid gold nuggets are going to be changes in the tone of voice. It's going to be how you can get them to re-explain something more than once. I mean, you're really trying to get them to go back and forth over ground a couple of times because they're going to say a little bit differently each time and something special is going to jump out at you. The best analogy I can think of is, you know, Kevin Durant recently talking about signing with the Golden State Warriors when everybody thought he was going to stay with the Thunder. And, you know, when he put out a statement about why he went, he mentioned a couple things that didn't really have anything to do with basketball. He talked about his development as a man, as a development as a person. So somewhere in the negotiations, somebody on the Warriors side caught that was important to him. And they fed it back to him, and then they reacted on it, and they adjusted their stance. And not in 9 million years would anybody have said, well, let's approach Kevin Durant, tell him we're going to make him a better man.
Right.
But that was really important to him, and somebody with the Warriors caught that. And that's, in a hostage negotiation, we always said, what's it going to take to get the guy to come out? Well, he's going to tell us, but you have to listen between the lines. And that was exactly what was going on with Kevin Durant. You got to hear the stuff that you would never expect, but have your ears open to it, and then it gives you all the advantages that no one else has because so few people listen for those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's almost like you're looking for the subtext in everything that people are saying, sort of, yeah, like you said, reading between the lines. But that's what's so interesting about that detail that you have five different people listening to the same thing. That's, we recently had a episode about a guy who has this firm that uses swarm decision-making to make decisions, and they actually used that to predict the win place show and fourth place finisher of the Kentucky Derby in the correct order. And it's almost, again, this wisdom of groups, like having a lot of manpower or bandwidth at your disposal, kind of paying close attention to the right things really can come in handy.
Yeah, and it's definitely the subtext. And once you start getting into subtext, it'll have so many layers. And if you want to try to catch it the first time, that the five listeners that you talked about, you know, each one is going to have a different job. And one person, their only job might be to log how long the person talks. Because the longer the talk, the more comfortable they are. And the more comfortable they are, the more honest they're going to be with what they say to us. So, you know, just tiny little things like that can make a huge difference.
Didn't you also say at one point in the book that people will use more language when they're lying? And that's something, basically, it is exactly like Pinocchio, except instead of the nose getting longer, the words that they're using, the sentences that they're using get longer.
Well, you know, just more language, but when they're trying to convince you. And it's the context of what they're saying. And so, quite definitely, you know, the liar knows he's lying, and he knows there's a pretty good chance you're not going to buy into it. So he knows the more he tries to convince you or the more eloquent he gets, the better he can sidestep the issue. And the guy's telling the truth. Since he knows he's telling the truth, they tend to be a little more short-tempered and direct because they know it's the truth and they can't believe that you're not smart enough to figure it out. And they get annoyed when you can't figure it out.
You come out of a career negotiating for hostages, which I think people have a very limited understanding of how that goes. It's like you get on the phone with the person and, you know, make ultimatums, and then they ask to order pizza. You know, there's like a few standard movie tropes, but can you kind of disabuse our listeners of that notion, just kind of what you were looking for going into any hostage negotiation?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're looking to trigger a thread. And I suppose you asked before about gambits. The only gambit we would ever do was in the opening statement. Like a hostage negotiator, the only thing that they're going to rehearse is their opening statement. And it's designed to actually catch the other guy off so off guard that they say to themselves, what in the world is this guy going to say next? And then as soon as they're thinking that, then they're completely glued to what it is that you have to say. That's why we got so many people listening, because we don't know for sure what that threat is going to be. And we need somebody to catch it right away so that we can pull on it. And it seems like an arduous process, but actually I always love the phrase, the delay to save time. The more closely we listen and the more we take our time, the faster this thing's going to be over. Because the other guy's actually dying to tell us what's going on. And we just want to make him feel like that he's not going to get it slammed down his throat. So people love good listeners. They unburden themselves very quickly.
Can you give an example of an opening statement that you came up with to get the guy off his guard, and sort of what his response was that offered you guys a thread that you were able to pull at?
You know, a hostage negotiator might say off the bat when the other guy answers the phone, are you okay? Because he's going to expect me to want to ask about the hostages. And if my first concern is his safety, then we've actually immediately established a common ground in the future, which is the key to any negotiation. If there's a success point in the future that we both like, we can now both work towards that end. And so a hostage taker is not going to expect me to actually care about him. And if that's my first concern, he's going to say, wow, where's this guy coming from? And he's going to want to hear more.
You talk in your book about the 150 cognitive biases covered by Daniel Kahneman in his book, Thinking Fast and Thinking Slow. And seems like the sort of thing that you're extremely well educated in, just all these different things that affect the way people and sort of distort the way people see reality. Are there certain of those that come into play more than people might realize in just day-to-day conversations or negotiations?
Yeah, you know, some psychologists contend that every single decision we make is based on fear of loss. Some won't quite go that far, but they say it's a dominating factor. So what we're concerned about losing, you know, and you mentioned Danny Kahneman, they came up with a Nobel Prize winning theory that said that loss stings twice as much as the equivalent gain, which is, you know, they took the Nobel Prize for these guys to get that. But I've listened to interviews of Super Bowl champions who both won and lost Super Bowls, and heard sportscasters say, well, loss stings twice as bad as a win does. So, you know, we're kind of driven by loss. And while that might not be the only way we evaluate things, I know it's such a dominating factor, and we're so much more influenced by potential loss, that that's actually what I listen for first. What's the person worried about losing? Which is kind of the opposite of what we think we want to do in negotiations, because in a business negotiation, the first thing we want to do is, well, we want to pitch the gain. You know, what's my gain going to bring them? And I know that I got a psychological advantage in any negotiation if I start focusing on how we're going to avoid a loss, because you're going to be spurred at least twice as strongly by that. Maybe some people contend up to 9 times as strongly. So the loss is the biggest thing, and how it disguises itself.
Can you give an example of maybe in a hostage negotiation or kidnapping negotiation, how you would focus on what the person's afraid of losing, and then maybe an example from, you know, business or just everyday life?
To try to uncover it in a hostage negotiation, you know, we're going to say, what's this all about? And he's probably going to fumble and stumble over his words and talk about 4, 5, 6 things. And probably the second or third thing out of his mouth is going to be where it's really coming from. So it might be like, look, you know, I lost my job. My wife left me. Anything that triggers a fear of loss in somebody's mind where they're not sure exactly where the future is going to go. in any given business deal, the loss might be the loss of their position or the loss of the standing that they have inside. You know, the phrase, what's in it for me, is so universal that you have to talk to the other person and find out, why are they talking to you in the first place? They're trying to keep up in some way that if they don't keep up, they would otherwise fall behind, which is a loss. So you're gonna want to uncover what that is, what's the most driving factor that's moving them forward. And very rarely does it have to do with the good of the organization comes second. The good of their own personal life and their own personal career is what comes first. Interestingly enough, you know, we heard recently there was a training bid that was out for negotiation for one of the international telephone carriers, very well-known carrier. And we began to find out about their process of negotiating contracts, and we were told that fully 50% of their contracts that don't go through are because they're killed internally. And they're killed internally by people that are not involved in the deal, and the people kill them internally because they're mad that they're not involved in the deal, and if the deal goes through without them, then they lose status inside the company. So if they can't make the deal themselves, they're going to do everything they can to kill it because they're afraid of their loss of status internally. They don't care whether or not the company makes money.
Because status within the company is a zero-sum game. So if somebody else closes a deal that they're not involved in, then that person gains ahead of them. And that's interesting that major corporations would have that sort of inefficiency going on. But I guess the bigger the corporation, the higher the stakes, the more likely you are to see that sort of stark contrasts.
Right. Well, yeah, and it doesn't take that big of a corporation for the employees to start becoming competitive internally.
Yeah, that's true. Can you talk about how you've used your hostage negotiating skills in everyday life?
Yeah, you know, I use it in everyday life as much to practice, and then the benefits come to me on a regular basis in little ways. Because, you know, if you want to perform well in the Super Bowl, you got to play in preseason. So just on a general basis, you know, the two easiest hostage negotiation skills that fit into nearly every conversation I have are what we call labels, where you just say to somebody, "Look, it seems like this is really important to you," or, you know, it seems like there's more room to maneuver here, or it seems like maybe there's something else going on here. That's a label when you say it seems like. And you can roll that into any given conversation. And you really ought to use that before you answer any question, because people are so bad at asking questions, they usually don't even ask you the right one. And then the other skill I use on a regular basis is a skill called mirroring, which is just repeating the last 1 to 3 words of what somebody has just said. Or if I really want to show off, I'll pick out 1 to 3 words in the middle of what they said. And, you know, I've got a client that mirrors the bargaining positions of everyone in every negotiation he's ever in. Now, it would seem like that would be repetitive to do that, but you get long enough answers from the other side, you find out right away whether or not they're firm in their position or whether they're soft and there's room to maneuver. And that's why he does it all the time. He also does it all the time because he's actually a really smart guy, and he loves showing people, without them knowing it, that he's smarter than they are.
So now I should say that he's smarter than they are? And you would keep talking? Is that how it works?
You know, and actually, if you'd have just mirrored me, I probably would have just kept talking. Because I've had people pull that on me a lot. And since I like explaining stuff, you know, it's one of the stories in a book when one of my employees mirrored me for about 45 minutes till my son started yelling at me because he couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, journalists, one of the first tricks that they teach you in journalism is like, to just be comfortable with silence. And just, if you've ever spoken with a journalist, they will leave these long, awkward silences for you to fill. And it can be very unnerving, but it's a great way to get people to talk, because a lot of people just can't stand awkward silences. So they'll fill it with words. But it sounds like mirroring kind of is a way of doing that that keeps it on topic, keeps them moving in the direction about whatever you guys are talking about, whatever you guys are negotiating over, right?
Right. And mirroring combined with silence at different times, that's a great 1-2 punch. So, and you know, we call silence effective pauses, but it has that title because it is effective, just exactly like as you said.
Hey, Hey guys, we're listening to The Rhythm Changes by Kamasi Washington, who is the saxophonist in the studio band that helped compose Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly. It's just a lovely song that's central, repeating, lyrical motif is about changing feelings, which seems to be one of the things that we talk about looking out for when trying to read the person you're talking to. So hope you enjoy it and enjoy these words from our sponsors.
Bodies, our feelings, they change, they alter, they leave us somehow. No matter what happens, I'm here.
Hey guys, the Crack Podcast is sponsored this week by Harry's Razors, a product that I use every day that I feel like shaving, which is way more frequently now that I've discovered Harry's. Before Harry's, I would literally dread shaving because of all the little nicks and red bumpy things I would get around my neck, not to mention razor burn. Ladies, I don't know if you deal with that too, but with all the other razors I used, my face would feel like it was on fire until I started shaving with Harry's. The best part is their replacement blades are half the price of the leading brand. The whole product is so well priced, it really won't cost you much to get started and see if it's for you. The starter set, which includes a razor handle, shaving cream, and three replacement blades, is just $15, you guys, and that gets knocked down to 10 when you use the code CRACKED at checkout. So go to harrys.com, that's harrys.com, and use promo code CRACKED to save $5 on the starter set and start shaving better today. And you'll also show your support for the Cracked Podcast. Thanks, Harry's. This episode is also sponsored by the Books. I don't know why I always say that like I'm a scary ghost. It's Books, as in bouquet of flowers. Listen, guys, you know no matter what you do around the house, you're probably bound to screw up. And you're also running out of fresh and inventive ways to apologize. Chocolates, don't cut it anymore. Skywriting is way too expensive and a little over the top. So consider saying, I'm sorry, or I love you, or hey, just thinking about you, buddy, with a bouquet of vibrant volcano-grown flowers. Yes, you heard me correctly. Books flowers are grown on eco-friendly farms on the side of a South American volcano, which results in larger blooms and blown minds. Now, flowers make you gun-shy because you were duped by a local florist into paying $100 for some roses last Valentine's Day. Books flowers start at a very reasonable $40, and there are no upcharges or extra fees, and delivery is free when you register with the Books. And on top of that, listeners to our show can save 20% on the bouquet of their choice with promo code CRACKED at checkout. So yeah, get your special someone flowers this summer to say, I'm sorry, or I love you. Go to Books.com, that's Bouqs.com, and enter code CRACKED for 20% off any bouquet. Thanks, Books. So you make a point in your book that people assume that most hostage takers are crazy, and you've negotiated with people who have chopped people's heads off and, you know, are these really monstrous figures and just really terrifying people. And your job, it seems like you view your job as not ever dismissing anyone as crazy, but actually, you know, finding the humanity and like really empathizing with pretty hard to empathize with people.
Well, and that depends upon your definition of empathy. Daniel Goleman's got a version of empathy that he calls cognitive empathy. And he says it's a type of empathy that sociopaths are best at. Because it doesn't require me to resonate with you or to feel what you're feeling emotionally to be able to identify it. I mean, I can see that you're angry without me being angry. And I can know that anger is a result of a loss without me feeling that, because anger is always a resultant emotion based on you think you're going to lose something. You see somebody gets angry all the time, they're totally driven by fear of loss, because that's what makes you angry, if you're afraid you're going to lose something. So I don't have to feel that anger. in order to be able to identify it. And that's why there was even a recent article called The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence, because as soon as you let go of empathy equating to sympathy, and it's just instinctively sensing somebody else's emotions and then feeding them back to them for effect, I mean, that's so powerful that somebody actually wrote an article called The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence.
With the thesis that it's possible to manipulate people, basically?
Not just possible. It's being done on a constant and regular basis
right.
by some of the most dangerous people on the planet.
Yeah, we actually just had an episode. This week's episode was about cults. And I believed in the early days of the internet that, freedom of information is the way of the future, and we'll never have these cults again because, you know, how could you be in a cult if you know how to use Google? And you can Google the name of the cult and you'll find out all there is to know about it. But we spoke with an expert in mind control who was saying that it's actually becoming a really effective way for people to mind control other people because everybody has the ability to create their own propaganda and lure people in. He was talking about there's a YouTube cult and ISIS, obviously, are these groups that are able to appeal to these really powerful emotions and manipulate people via the internet.
I refer to it as knowing what somebody's religion is. I mean, everybody's got something that they want to believe in that's bigger than themselves. Like every person on the planet. And not, it doesn't have to be a religion per se. It doesn't have to be Christianity per se. I mean, I've worked with plenty of bureaucrats that what they believed in bigger than themselves was the bureaucracy. But boy, once you tap into that, you know, you find somebody that bleeds FBI blue, and they will then begin to do anything to carry out the FBI's mission. So all you got to do is listen to their religion. Everybody's got something they believe in that's bigger than themselves.
You pointed out at one point, just kind of offhandedly in your book, the idea that iPhones price, like starting out at $600, is an example of anchoring. It's like so far above what anyone would typically pay for a cell phone. But then when they lower it to $400, it seems like a deal. And it's just an example of a public thing that I think everybody is familiar with that is taking advantage of some of these cognitive biases. It seems like a lot of your book is about analyzing subtext and, I guess, getting people talking with open-ended questions. Can you talk a little bit about sort of the types of questions that you suggest people ask when they're getting into negotiating situations?
Yeah, and here's the crazy thing. Every single question you ask somebody is going to trigger an emotional response in them. And, you know, we're taught to ask good questions, but we the reality is the vast majority of questions that people ask are questions where we're trying to elicit a yes. And every time you say yes to something, you commit yourself, and we always worry about what we're committing ourselves to. So you can't ask someone a question where the answer is going to be yes without making them hesitant, defensive, and backing up. So getting out of that habit is really hard, because we're also trying to constantly confirm information before we move forward. And we want to say, you know, isn't it true that this is the off-season in your hotel? Because we want a discount in a room. We're just trying to confirm a certain piece of information, but the person we're talking to knows where that's going, so it's going to make them defensive. Now, the two world champion questions to ask on a regular basis are questions that start with the word what and how, and asked in a deferential way. I mean, you can take any question and make it an accusation, or by your tone of voice, you can say, well, you know, how am I supposed to do that? Instead of, how am I supposed to do that? One's an accusation and the other is asking for help. That is such a powerful question, because people love to answer how questions. What do you want me to do? That does the same thing.
So what would be a good opening question to start the conversation with the hotelier instead of, isn't it true that this is your off season? You would want to angle that question so that they started out by saying no, right?
Yeah, well, then you get into another great point. How do people react emotionally when they say the word no? I mean, no is protection. So people always center themselves is the best way that I can describe it. They become more rational. They become calmer. They feel protected. And they think more productively and more quickly right after they've said no. So if you can trigger a way to ask a question, no, and I might be, you know, a hotel guy, if I know his more expensive rooms are vacant because it's the off season and they discounted the regular rooms, but they didn't discount the more expensive rooms, I might say, you know, is it ridiculous for me to ask about how many rooms you have of your more expensive rooms that are open? I mean, just the fact that he's going to say no is going to calm him down. And what we found the crazy thing is that you will absolutely be amazed at what people are willing to say no to, even when it's an obviously manipulative question. An obviously manipulative yes question, I mean, it backs people up right away. Like, would you like to make more money, which is almost every single sales pitch.
Right.
That is so obviously manipulative that, you know, if you ask somebody that, they want to reach across the table and strangle you because they know you're trying to trap them. But you can say, you know, do you like leaving money on the table? No, because the answer is no, they protected themselves.
Right.
So you'd be stunned at what people will say no to. And even if it's clearly in your favor that they say no, they'll still say it because they feel protected by it.
Whereas I feel like I have a almost instinctive sort of addiction to yes. Like I want whoever I'm talking to agree with what I'm saying. Is that common or am I just a weirdo?
No. You're right on the money and that's the crazy thing about a couple of these negotiation techniques, because we love hearing yes so much. It's actually, some people have referred to it as the most beautiful word in the English language, because we know how much we love to hear it. And there's an interesting story about John Lennon supposedly first started to fall in love with Yoko Ono when he went to this interactive art exhibit that she put together, and you had to climb over stuff and under stuff, and then you climbed up this rickety ladder, and at the top was a telescope, and you looked through the telescope, and in tiny little letters on a far wall was the word, yeah. Because she knew how much we love hearing it. And it's so crazy that I can say you love hearing it, and I could turn around and say, would you like to make more money? And when I try to pull it out of you, you get defensive.
It's almost like a selfish exchange where nothing is happening because it's just, yeah, I see what you're doing, and you want me to say yes, great, good for you, and nothing is being accomplished. Like you have this other red flag that you call out where the difference between saying that's right and you're right. If somebody says you're right when you're kind of having an argument with them, that just means fuck off. Like I don't want to continue having this conversation. Whereas that's right, you are kind of your most beautiful two words in the English language in this book.
Yeah, you know, and you're right thing, I realized the other day, and you really are, by saying you're right, you're trying to get somebody to shut up and stop bothering you, but you're also wanting to feel good and maintain the relationship at the same time. And then that's right doesn't feel as good to us when we hear it, but think about, like, you're watching TV and something happens that you saw in the news that you were so satisfied by. I mean, you jump up, you point at this TV, you don't yell out, you're right, you yell out, that's right! Because that's how, when we pronounce something to be the complete and utter truth, that's what we say. We don't say, you're right, we say, that's right. And it's almost the exact opposite dynamic of what happens with yes.
It's almost like, yes, you've exactly summed up how I'm feeling, and that's sort of the place that you want to get to in negotiating, or at least in your model, is you want them to feel understood, right? And once somebody feels understood, it seems like a lot of the resistance falls away.
Right. You know, it's two really powerful things simultaneously. And it's feeling understood, which is a signal. When somebody looks at you and says, that's right, they're telling you they feel this bond of empathy with you at that moment. And that's really powerful. And then if you've said it in a way that's triggered an epiphany in them, it's kind of like a double whammy in positive ways that moves them towards you. Because, you know, when we reach epiphany moments, we all know how that feels. That's why there's a term for it, because it's a moving moment. And when you create that, you move them towards you with this, like, double cattle prod that's enormously powerful.
Hey folks, we're listening to DJ Premier in Deep Concentration off Gangstar's debut album. I'm not crazy about most hip-hop from the 80s, but this is one of those songs that feels timeless and yet very location-specific to New York hip hop. And it's about concentration, which seems to be a skill that you need to have an effective conversation, according to our guest today. I can't get over that anecdote about the FBI having five people listening to the call. And, you know, one of them listens for how long the person speaks for, and the other person's listening for the tone, and then they come together and compare notes. It's such a detailed, finely honed process that's so much more interesting than the bullshit you see in movies with, you know, one dumbass cop on the phone while the other guy tells them to keep him talking so they can get a location. And their most insightful analysis is something like, well, this guy means business, or he wants to let us know he's in control. Anyways, hope you enjoy this song and these words from our sponsor. Crack Podcast is sponsored this week by Spotify Discover Weekly. This is one of my favorite new products. Discover Weekly is this awesome new feature on Spotify that gives you 30 songs each week that you didn't know you loved yet. Every Monday, you're delivered a brand new playlist that's like getting a mixtape from a much cooler friend of yours who knows your exact taste in music and wants you to stay young and hip with the kids these days. If you're a regular listener, you know finding new music is a big part of what I try to bring to this podcast. And if you're wondering how to stay current and expand your musical horizons, or what music you can find and yell at me for not having discovered yet, Discover Weekly is a great way to get started. So get lost in new music and defeat each soul-crushing Monday with Discover Weekly. It really is an awesome thing to come into on Monday and be like, oh, 30 new songs that have a really high hit ratio. So all you got to do is head over to spotify.com/discoverweekly to get your first playlist. Once again, to get 30 new tracks every Monday that you've probably never heard before and will probably love, go to spotify.com/discoverweekly. I think everybody at one point or another has to negotiate around a salary figure, right? Whether they're negotiating somebody else's or their own. And you have kind of some very specific and fairly easy to remember steps for how to go about doing that.
Right, yeah. Well, and then to look beyond salary, because salary pays your bills, but terms make your career. I mean, so you've got to build stuff around the salary that make it a great job. Well, the flip side is, the thing you also have to worry about is, you know, if it's blood money where you hate the job and you hate people that you work for, it doesn't matter how much they're paying you, it's just going to be a horrible place to work, which again gets right to terms. Or even dead-end jobs. You know, what good is this job going to do me if it doesn't build my life? So there's kind of an interesting double effect. As soon as you start focusing on non-price terms, non-salary terms, well then, you know, your employer is going to be less emotional about it because these are soft things to them. And you're going to find latitude and you're going to find better deals there for yourself. The flip side is also, you know, I had one person that I was coaching in a salary negotiation. She was pushing really hard for more vacation. And that actually was potentially a bigger problematic area because she got a week more vacation than everybody else, they were going to have an employee revolt. So what they countered with instead of the extra vacation was more salary. If you push on non-salary terms and it's a term that they're not emotional about, and because it's non-salary, they won't be emotional. There's a pretty good chance when you push them to the limit, they'll counter by offering you more money.
And by not being so kind of tunnel vision, laser focused on the salary number, you come across as more human and less greedy, less black and white. So that offers some variety and kind of humanizes you a little bit. You have a saying in the book, I'm probably going to butcher it, but never get so focused on the answer that you want that you miss a better answer or better terms.
Right. Never be so sure of what you want that you wouldn't take something better.
Yeah, I can totally see how getting so locked in on one specific area can blind you to all the other things that you can be kind of asking for and negotiating around.
Right, right. And there's some real cutthroat negotiators out there. Like Carl Icahn is famous for knowing that people are so focused on price that he's going to manipulate you into a price, and then he's going to kill you with the terms. And there have been a lot of deals cut in China that have turned out to be horrible deals because they gave the Chinese businessmen involved, gave great prices. You know, over the last few years, everybody said, China's where the money is. China's where the money is. And then you turn around and you look at how many homes in Florida are still vacant because they got Chinese drywall in them. Like something was built into that deal that ended up making it a horrible deal for the other side. They got suckered into it because the price was so good.
Yeah, that's interesting. Sorry, you said Carl Icahn?
Carl Icahn, you know, is one example of an investor that understood that people are always so price-focused that once they get the price, they're going to drop their guard and really, at best, maybe 65% of the deal is only done at that point. And since Carl Icahn knows the counterpart's going to drop the guard, he's going to kill you with the terms. I mean, that's one of the things he became very famous for.
Being famous for being a great negotiator isn't necessarily a good thing, as you point out.
Yeah, you know, I would tell you, I'll bet you, I think probably the greatest negotiator on the planet might be Warren Buffett, and that is not what he's famous for. He's famous for having a cool head and making great stock picks. But how does he get himself in that position, and how does he cut those deals? And how is Berkshire Hathaway worth, so what is a ridiculous amount per share? What are they up? Was it $185,000 a share last I heard? It's probably even higher than that. Well, I think Warren Buffett's probably one of the world's greatest negotiator, and that's not what he's famous for.
Wow, $213,000 a share. Not bad.
There you go. Yeah. I could live with 10 shares, right?
Yeah. Do you have any stories of Warren Buffett? You say Mark Cuban is another person who's a pretty great negotiator.
You know, I like Cuban a lot. I like watching Mark Cuban on Shark Tank because people call him a bully, and he's not, and he knows he's not, and he's not the least bit rattled by name calling. You know, his negotiation style really is he's constantly testing entrepreneurs. Because when you're in a negotiation, especially a job negotiation, and that's what that negotiation is on Shark Tank, Mark Cuban wants to see if you can stand up for yourself and not get pushed around and in a nice way. And I can remember one time in particular, you know, he loves to give these, you know, take this deal now before you talk to anybody else. Take it or leave it. You can't hear another offer. Give me an answer, yes or no. And the entrepreneur effectively said to him, you know, you wouldn't want me to get pushed around like that when I'm negotiating on your behalf, would you? And, you know, the answer to that is no. And Cuban was so impressed that he let him talk to the other investors. And you could see the light bulb turning on over Cuban's head saying, like, this guy can hold his own. And he can hold it in a nice way. He didn't get rattled. He didn't get upset. So, you know, I really like the way Mark Cuban handles himself. And he doesn't want you to know that he's always open to negotiation. He's only open to negotiation if you've got an A game. And at that point in time, he wants to deal with you.
Are there any famous stories about Warren Buffett being a great negotiator?
The way he got involved in bailing the banks out and offering advice during the financial crisis, and I've only seen or know of it from what has been portrayed in a couple of the films. But, you know, there were a bunch of scared Wall Street bankers that didn't know which way to turn. And in a very calm, reassuring way, they started calling him and asking him questions. And he became very involved in the deal. And I'm sure that everyone would have said every conversation with Warren Buffett in that time frame was a negotiation. But he was working collaboratively with people where he's not going to give in and make a bad deal, but he's trying really hard to make good deals with those guys. So I think, from what I've seen, and I wish I would have been a fly on the wall in his office when they were having those conversations. I think he showed himself to be a phenomenal negotiator during the banking crisis and was probably one of the few people that stopped the system from completely melting down.
One thing that I came away from your book pretty sure of is that I'm too afraid of conflict. And that's something that seems to be foundational to, I guess, any negotiation. But you talk about how we tend to demonize people in our culture and assume that if you're, you know, negotiating with someone, then you're adversaries, and you view it more as like a partnership where the bad guy is the conflict. It's the circumstances, and you're trying to come up with basically a mutually beneficial arrangement.
Right, exactly. And it's much as to keep my own emotions in check, to say the adversary is the situation. So now the guy on the other side of the table might see it as adversarial, but that doesn't mean that I have to. And I'm going to engage in my process where I'm going to try to be collaborative with you. I'm going to try to feel you out. I'm trying to figure out whether or not I can get you into a position where you're going to stop attacking me, or actually I'm going to walk away. But I'm going to do it in a nice way, because I know that human nature tells us that we remember things how they end. We don't remember them how they begin. So I'm going to make sure that I leave all my interactions on a positive note, because you're going to talk about me. That's how our reputations precede us wherever we go, based on how our last interaction ended with the last person we talked to, because that's a residue that they remember. So yeah, I am going to try to make this a collaborative process, and I'm going to try to help you see me in a different light. I'm going to use very tactical use of empathy. You know, sometimes I refer to it as weapons-grade empathy. And I'm going to see, when you see me in a negative light, I'm going to diffuse that. And when you see me in a positive light, I'm going to encourage that. And that's going to increase the chances we're going to make a deal.
I do think that that involves not being afraid of, in the moment-to-moment interaction, coming into conflict.
I rambled a little bit there. Get us back to conflict. How do we view the conflict is the question. And a lot of people hate conflict, so much so that they'd rather walk away from a good deal than have to get to that good deal through conflict. So I just say, well, I know you don't want to get into a conflict. How do you feel about a focus comparison? Because a focus comparison is another definition of confrontation. So if we just simply reframe this, and I'm going to say, well, here's A and here's B, how do we reconcile these two things? And in a negotiation, I could say, look, you say you want to make a deal with me, and you keep making threats. How do those two things add up? I mean, that's very confrontational, but it's designed to diffuse the conflict.
And it's also kind of an open-ended question. That seems to be a big tool in your arsenal, is asking people open-ended questions, because it kind of exhausts them and gets them to also more thoroughly consider their position and your position.
Yeah, you know, you're on the money there. And really, I would almost entirely limit to those open-ended questions to how and what questions. I will tell you, we say how, what, and sometimes why, and actually probably rarely why, because anytime I ask you why, it's an accusation. We never ask anybody why unless we think they're wrong. And of all the people that I've ever taught negotiations, the one takeaway that they can all almost... every one of them remembers, never ask why. Instead of say, why do you want that? Or why did you do what you did? Change your whys to what. What made you want that? What caused you to do what you did? But why is always an accusation. And unless you're very, very precisely calculating that, you don't want that defensiveness it's going to create.
You open the book with a story of you're kind of called into this Harvard School of Management professor's room, and they're kind of doing a negotiation with you, and you just say, well, how do you expect me to do that? And you do that again once you're in the Harvard course, and you have a lot of success kind of wearing down these people who have a lot of academic management negotiation training by just exhausting them with how questions.
Yeah, I got to tell you what, that's an emotional intelligence-based approach. You know, weapons-grade emotional intelligence. And, you know, the people that want or think they can operate with rationality, which is how they were approaching me, it's a setup. I got them. I know I got them. And I know what the how question does to people, and I use it on a regular basis.
There's some study that studied Israeli judges, and so they were people who reviewed parole applicants, and they found that they were way more likely to acquit people in the morning when they had a lot of energy, and then as the day went on and they lost energy, they would just kind of go through and, you know, stamp denied until lunch, at which point they would have a break, get some extra fuel, and then they would go back to, you know, actually considering each of the cases. And that was the number one determining factor, was when your appeal came up in the day for the judge. And it seems like that's an acknowledgement that everybody only has a certain amount of mental energy to expend comes into play in your negotiating method.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's also one of the beauties of getting people to say no, because I actually know if I'm dealing with someone who's tired and worn out and I need them cooperative, I'll start getting them to say no because it'll perk them up.
Getting people to say no makes them kind of focus more?
It really does. And I've even got a rule in my company, and people who come to work for me, I say, in the afternoon, do not ask me any open-ended questions, because I am not going to answer them. I'm going to be tired. I'm not going to have the energy to give you an answer. And if you say to me at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, how do you want me to do this, I'm not answering. But if you can ask me a series of questions where the answer is no and we can move the ball forward, I can answer those and we'll move forward much more quickly. So there's a couple of different ways to use that to your advantage.
Do you have any reads? I think you mentioned Donald Trump offhandedly in the book at one point as just a reference to someone who might be powerful. Have you paid much attention to him as a negotiator?
Well, yeah, he's kind of the classic hard-nosed, aggressive, assertive, attacking negotiator, which was the first people that we had to learn to overcome when we were dealing in, you know, our international kidnapping negotiations, because they're commodities dealers and they work in a tough, hard-nosed environment. And Mr. Trump, who I have tremendous regard for, is basically a contractor from New York City. And that's a tough business. And being in the construction industry anywhere in the world, let alone in New York City, is a tough place. You know, so they're used to kicking chairs across rooms to get their point and yelling at people and stomping around and making threats. I mean, that's the way that industry operates. Not the only industry like that on the planet. He's very good at it. And as he's used to dealing with people like that, you know, the interesting analogy is, how's Paul Ryan dealing with Donald Trump? Well, Paul Ryan's a much quieter guy, and he's much more measured, and he doesn't get drawn into those conflicts. And you see, you know, whether Republican or Democrat, I kind of like the way Paul Ryan is interacting with the tough, loud, attacking negotiator. Paul Ryan seems to be not only holding his position, but maybe even gaining in regard around the world because of how well he's holding his position. And that's kind of the textbook way to deal with the assertive negotiator. Interestingly enough, I was reading an article the other day about Donald Trump's son-in-law. And they talk about how much influence Donald Trump's son-in-law has on him. And they paint a guy who is not openly aggressive. And they talk about a guy who really is much more measured, much more thoughtful, and not reactive. And it appears that he has tremendous influence on Donald Trump and tremendous trust and confidence from Trump. So I think that's a little bit of a recipe of how to deal with the tough, loud, attacking negotiator. You don't deal with them effectively yelling back. You can fight them to a standstill, but you can still take a tough, loud, attacking negotiator and have a collaborative relationship with them by changing up the game a little bit.
Yeah, you talk a couple of times about sort of emotional judo, or using emotional intelligence almost the way certain martial arts will use other people's momentum against them.
Right, you know, we refer to it as listener's judo, because you got to listen to what they're saying in order to find those key points. You know, one of the things that we talked about it a little bit, I mean, people are think so much that hostage negotiators are crazy and they don't have any, this doesn't have any analogy or application in my life. And, you know, I got to tell you something, you take the guns out of a typical bank robbery with hostages, and I think you got a Monday morning staff meeting with the boss.
Yeah.
Or maybe a holiday gathering with the family.
Yeah, it did seem like the conversations that were taking place were remarkably human. The people and their demands and their fears, once you are able to get through to those things, and they do kind of read like back and forth that you would have just with anyone in your life over any sort of conflict. At one point you say that people who refer to themselves a lot and say me and I when they first start talking to you. I don't know if this is specific to hostage and kidnapping negotiations, but if they refer to themselves a lot as the actor, then you tend to find that they actually don't have that much power. Whereas if they refer to, you know, some other person who is making the decisions, then you tend to find that they are actually just really smart negotiators who are probably calling the shots. Is that just because we're right. full of shit or as a species, or is that just something that you think happens because these are dishonest people?
Dishonest is a harsh word. I mean, I think when the most influential person in a deal is at the table, they know they can get cornered, and they don't want to get cornered too quickly, so they're going to constantly defer to people outside the room. And we had this absolutely happen. And, you know, the bank robbery with hostages at the Chase Manhattan Bank, I mean, the guy that drove the whole situation from the other side, he was constantly talking about how scared he was of the other guys and how they were more dangerous than he was. I mean, constantly referring to these guys. And that was before I knew this dynamic. And initially we thought this guy was just somehow he had an inadequate personality because he spent so much time talking about how worried he was about the other guys. And then I had a kidnapping internationally where it was a lone kidnapper and he didn't want us to know it. And he kept talking about all the other people he was involved with because he was deferring. You know, he didn't want us to see how influential he was. And I just came to know that in hostage taking. Initially, I just presumed it was true of human nature. I read an article recently that said that's exactly what goes on in business deals. So, it's human nature, whether you're a hostage taker or whether you're trying to take hostages in business.
Hey, yo, kids!
What's up?
Remember when I used to be dope?
Yeah.
I own a pocket full of fame.
But look what you're doing now.
I know. Well, I know. I lost touch.
Oh, right. That was our conversation. This is Fallen by Teenage Fan Club and De La Soul off the Judgment Night soundtrack, the early 90s movie soundtrack concept album that brought the biggest names in rap together with the biggest names in metal to make mostly unlistenable music. But man, I love this particular song. And its chorus repeats, "You played yourself," over and over again, which is how Chris Voss would end phone calls with bad guys if he was a movie character. Put down the phone, Voorhees. You played yourself. I don't know why my fictional cop is negotiating with Jason from Friday the 13th, but he just is. The story about the Chase Manhattan bank robber that he refers to at the end, the guy who they were negotiating with who kept referring to all these other crazy guys who were really calling the shots, who he was like afraid of, turned out to basically be acting alone. And so he spent the whole time talking about basically imaginary friends. And I called it dishonest, but that's totally something I did when I first started Cracked and was the only person making decisions on what to publish. And yeah, I had an imaginary editorial board that I had to run stuff by so I could reject people's work without making them hate me. So I'm a bastard. It's interesting he has respect for Trump and Yoko Ono and Mark Cuban, who I guess are widely hated, but it makes sense that they'd be students of the everyday. They all fall into this category of people who, you know, don't come across as very likable at a distance. At a remove through the media, Trump, that might be an understatement depending on your political leanings, but who I'm assuming have tremendous emotional intelligence and charisma when you're in a room with them. We don't see their appeal through the media because they didn't become famous for being appealing through the media. They're geniuses of the thing that Voss studies that we all kind of take for granted, reading and interacting with people they're in a room with. And depending on how you feel about Trump, that proves that emotional intelligence can be used for Hitler-like aims or to make America great again, I guess, is what some people think he's doing. Anyways, yeah, after doing a deep dive into kind of his way of scrutinizing dynamics of everyday life, my ordinary way of living seems sort of blind and naive, just the idea that we're driven by fear, and that all anger is just buried fear is just an interesting insight. Anyways, hope you enjoyed it. On to some footnotes. We're going to link to a page where you can buy Chris's book, Never Split the Difference, which we talked about today, which I read. Very compelling reading. We're going to link to Thinking Fast and Slow, the first few chapters on Google Books, an amazing book. We're going to link to the Atlantic article, The Dark Side of Emotional Intelligence, the New York Times article titled Quiet Fixer in Donald Trump's Campaign, His Son-in-Law, Jared Kushner, which is an interesting take on how somebody can kind of use listening judo to control a bullying-ish force. And we're going to link to a Cracked article, Four Aspects of Hostage Situations Movies Didn't Prepare Me For, which is an article from a while back that I had totally forgotten about prior to this conversation, where we spoke to Gary Nosner, who's a 30-year veteran of crisis negotiation who was present for the first half of the Waco standoff in 1993. And when I went back and read it, the first piece of advice he gives is hostage negotiations are just like first dates and all about listening. So yeah, that's it for this week's episode. Oh, also this Saturday, July 16th at 7 p.m., we're going to be at UCB Sunset Theater to talk about The Afterlife. It's Daniel O'Brien, Michael Swaim, Casey Jane Ellison, Ramin Nasser, and me. And we're going to be talking about just different conceptions of the afterlife, whether it's obscure religions or pop culture afterlives. It's going to be a lot of fun. It always sells out, so go buy your tickets now. The link will be in the description. And that's it for this week. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow at Brett, R-A-D-E-R, on Twitter. You can follow me at Jack _ O-B-R-I-E-N. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you guys then.
Hey, yo, pack my bags, because I'm out of here. Mama don't love me and my mama don't care. Read the papers, the headlines say, washed up rapper got some. Lingo's busted while the guitar sways. B-side copy for the radio plays for something. I knew I blew the whole fandango when the drum programmer wore a Kango. Never could be like great fish, won't bite bait. Realize that I'm over like clover. No good luckin', so Mace beat the fucking beat. While a teenage fan the heat, I bring it to the clues, paid all my dues. So what's gone's dead, let me use my forehead. Easy pack it up, man, let me stop stalling. Cause everything I do is like falling.
Hey guys, just a reminder that this episode was sponsored by Spotify Discover Weekly. Discover Weekly allows you to lose yourself every week in the thrill of discovering new music. Your Discover Weekly playlist is 30 songs you didn't know you loved yet. You get a brand new, unique playlist every Monday, personalized to your tastes based on the music that you like listening to. It's like having a good friend who knows all the best new music and gives you weekly recommendations based on what you like. Go to Spotify.com/discoverweekly now to get your playlist. This episode was also sponsored by Books. Guys, you know, no matter what you do around the house, you're probably gonna screw something up. But one good way to smooth everything over is by sending flowers from thebooks.com. Books flowers are grown on eco-friendly farms on the side of a volcano. Yes, a volcano. So the blooms are larger, the colors more vibrant, the scent more volcano-y. Books prices start at just $40, no upcharges, no extra fees, even delivery is absolutely free, which is incredible, and you can save 20% at BOUQS.com with promo code CRACKED.
Hello, hello, this is Nagin Farsad, the host of Fake the Nation, where we talk about politics, we talk about news, and we have a laugh.
We were laughing.
Every week, a cast of my funniest, smartest, and most politically astute friends, people like John Fugelsang, Liz Winstead, Dean Obidala, and others, tackle all the major issues like climate change.
America leads the world in people who think climate change is fake.
but pro wrestling is real.
Guns!
I started calling the NRA the AK-47%.
Filibuster? I don't even know her! Okay, that's not a major issue, but it's a really great pun. Guys, Fake the Nation is all the comedy about politics without any of the politics about politics.
Fake the Nation!
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.